This conference will now be recorded.
For those of you who do not know me yet, my name is Mary Angela De Grazia De Tucci. Notice I always pause after my first name. That's because my name is so long. Not that I can't do it on one breath. It's just that some people can't distinguish where my first name is in all of that long name. So it's Mary Angela De Grazia De Tucci. I am a longtime patient with multiple digestive motility diseases. Mine started off as chronic idiopathic intestinal pseudoobstruction, and then over the years progressed to include gastroparesis, as well as my esophageal motility problems, and a host of other things. In 1991, I was honored to start this organization, and it truly is, when I say I am honored, I truly am honored, because for people to come to our organization as a source of support and not only support, but for good information and, you know, just talking to other people who understand is huge. And so it is a humbling thing. And also to find that there are some really dedicated doctors out there who really do want to help. And that is very hopeful for so many who have just struggled finding doctors who are understanding. On this call, as I said, we broke records with how many people registered this for this program, and we are delighted that you're here. In the conversation, we have Melissa, and you'll also hear Laura. And before I introduce them, I just want to say that we have a few ground rules within these, and that way there it makes it easier for people to join our conversation. And the first is, if you could say your first name every time you speak, that will make it easier for people to identify who is speaking. We can match that voice with the conversation. The other thing is, if please do not give your contact information or ask for anybody's contact information during the program. That way there we can maintain people's privacy. In addition, we want to respect people's rights. We want to make sure that you do not use any profanity during this program. And just be mindful, we have a lot of people on the program, so we want to make sure everybody gets a chance. If you have trouble jumping into the conversation, just call out Mary Angela, Melissa, Laura, or just say, I can't jump in. Somebody get me in, and we'll be sure to get you in. Melissa, will you introduce yourself, please?
Yes. My name is Melissa Adams Van Houten, and I'm a gastroparesis patient and advocate. I was diagnosed with gastroparesis almost 5 years ago in February of 2014, and have been volunteering with the AGMD for I don't know how long, but long enough that I know I really like it.
We really like you too. That's your introduction?
That's it.
Wow, short and sweet. Laura, do you want to top that?
I don't know if I can top it. Hi, everybody. My name is Laura Schmidt. I am a very long-time type 1 diabetic and sufferer of gastroparesis. I have been volunteering off and on with the AGMD for over a decade. And I am happy to help anyone. If you have any questions on this call or you can't get in, please just speak up real quick, because I have no problem speaking up to help you out.
Now, if you try to respond and you're not getting a response, it could be also because I muted you, because sometimes people forget. It's like a radio show. They want to hear themselves or join in the conversation, but they still have their radio tuned up. We can hear everything in your background, dogs barking, cats meowing, pots and pans, sinks running, toilets flushing. We can hear it all. So, yes, so just be mindful of that. And if you need to do any of those things, or if your dogs start barking or your cat starts meowing, just mute yourself so that everybody else won't be distracted. Thank you. So as far as I'm concerned with gastroparesis, I had said that mine started with pseudo-obstruction. So after years, it progressed. And I know that some people who have gastroparesis, they're diagnosed right away, and some of them take a long time to be diagnosed. Melissa, what is the protocol for being diagnosed with gastroparesis? Can I just start you off with that, and then we're just going to go from there?
Yeah, absolutely. I happen to be one of the lucky ones, lucky, I guess, who was diagnosed pretty quickly. I had symptoms come about pretty much overnight and went to the emergency room, and they admitted me to the hospital and did all sorts of tests, and then they were able to diagnose me at the end of a week. That is not the case for some people. I'd say that's probably not the case for most people. I've seen a lot of people wait months and even sometimes years for a proper diagnosis. And that is because this is not an easy disorder, condition, illness, disease, whatever you want to call it, to diagnose, because it can mimic symptoms of other illnesses. And a lot of doctors just really don't think of it as the first possibility. And they also, you know, to diagnose, you sort of have to rule out other things like some kind of intestinal blockage or obstruction or some kind of physical deformity, structural deformity. So a lot of times they will do tests like a colonoscopy, an upper endoscopy, CT scans, you know, barium screens, and those sorts of things before they ever get to what's considered the gold standard for diagnosing, which is the gastric emptying study. For those of you who have been through it, you probably know that's not a lot of fun to go through. If you are struggling with gastroparesis, it's not a difficult test, and for a normal person, it would not be a painful test. But for those of us who do struggle with eating, you know, you are asked to eat a meal, and then that food is tracked for a few hours while images are taken through your digestive tract to see how slow your stomach is emptying. And you are asked to please not vomit when you're going through this test, or the test must end and they cannot properly track the rate of emptying. So it can be a difficult test, but that is considered the gold standard for diagnosing. There's also a smart pill out there that some are turning to at this point, but it's not quite as common and not as well known.
And I think a lot of insurances don't pay for that smart pill, yes, if I'm correct, or they don't reimburse, yes, doctors or hospitals. The other thing is I have been really educated, and to my dismay, of all the variants on that gastric emptying test as far as the meals, what they do, how they prepare, how long. And it has been very eye-opening. Have you found that, Melissa, in your groups?
Oh, absolutely. I'm shocked. There should be a standard protocol for conducting the gastric emptying study. And you know, you can find somewhere on the AGMD website where we did a radio program just on what's required or what should be required for that gastric emptying study. And basically, they have numbers that say, here are the normal percentages, and if you're this much delayed, you're either mild or moderate or severely delayed. But those numbers are designed based on a certain meal, and that is typically eggs and toast with jelly and some water to drink. But some people have trouble with that meal, and they receive substitutes like oatmeal. That's a common one I've heard. Some people can only do liquids, and the numbers for liquids would be possibly different than the ones for solids. And I'm hearing variations lately. I've heard beef stew and yogurt, and someone was talking about having Ensure for a solid emptying test, which to me does not seem like a solid. That does not seem accurate to me. So there's kind of strange stuff going on out there that I'm hearing about lately.
Eye-opening. And so now you have that diagnosis of gastroparesis. It has that name. And then you're sent home. And then what? You're left to deal with this. And I know Laura has, she's a type 1 diabetic. She has the neurogastric stimulator, which has helped her a lot with not having to go to hospitalizations as much because of that nausea and constant vomiting that she had before. Doesn't mean that she still doesn't go visit because she always has to touch bases with her friends at the hospital. Is that correct, Laura?
Absolutely. Every few years, no matter what, if we have to.
So I'm going to open up this conversation and just ask all of you, now that you have that diagnosis, were you given any assistance and guidance as to how to live with this, what to eat, where to get support? Or did you find all of this on your own, or are you still searching? Anybody want to jump in?
Sure.
Hi,
Laura.
This is Deb.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. This is Debbie Pop.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Melissa. So what happened with me is I had gastroparesis much before I ended up in the hospital with a perforated bowel, but it went undiagnosed. I was in the hospital for 8 weeks. And then once I did get diagnosed was by my home health care nurse. And she suggested I needed to go and see a GI and get a gastric emptying study done. I finally got diagnosed after I had already lost, like at that time, probably 90 pounds. And now I'm down 130 pounds and my GI is now telling me, after losing my colon and now have motility issues in my small bowel and esophagus, that he believes everything's coming from my bowel. That's what's causing all the gastroparesis problems. And my biggest difficulty is when I met with a nutritionist, they were advising me what to eat for gastroparesis, which is somewhat in conflict with what I can eat for my bowel problems. So I feel like I just came off of liquids again, and I feel completely lost. I have a really good doctor who's working with me right now, but he's starting the whole process all over. I just can't understand, and I guess frustrated with that. I laid in the hospital 8 weeks on TPN and all horrible things and an NG tube and went undiagnosed. And now that I have been diagnosed, I don't really feel like there's any answers.
I'm sorry that you've gone through all of that and you're going through that. And I know so many of us can relate with that frustration and waiting for that diagnosis. And then your whole life changes once again once you get that diagnosis. Does anybody want to respond to that? No, we have a quiet team here, people.
This is Melissa.
Hi, this is Eileen DePerry.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Miss Eileen.
Oh, thank you, Melissa. I had the same thing. I went through a doctor who first diagnosed me with gastroparesis, but nothing was helping me. Reglan, domperidone, the diets, nothing was helping me. So I found a so-called specialist, and I went to the specialist and he said, you don't have gastroparesis, you're just constipated. So he gave me this regimen of Miralax that I had to take with every meal. And I spent all my time in the bathroom. And it did not help the gastroparesis. Believe me, it did not help. It made it so much worse. So I went back to my regular GI doctor And we're back to square one again. Just square one. So and here I went to a specialist and he knew nothing.
Yeah, that's unfortunately a theme that we have heard before from other patients. And it's just heart-wrenching to hear what so many patients endure. I mean, like Melissa said, she was very fortunate that she got diagnosed right away and has been on track, although she's had some doctor situations. But nevertheless, you know, she was diagnosed quickly. And I think, Laura, because of what happened with you, you got quick treatment as well for your neurostimulator there. But there are so many who do feel so frustrated and lost because of what they are enduring, and they just don't know what to do, and the guidance that they're getting is just not enough because you live with this 24 hours a day. Anybody want to go ahead?
This is Melissa. It's very tough, and I mean I see this in the groups all the time. I can't stress it enough. You know, people, they think that because they have a name for their condition now, for their illness, that means a cure, that means they're going to get better. And, you know, that's your expectation before you know anything about this illness. You think, well, I'll just take a pill and I'll be done with this. Thank goodness they know what it is. And it's not like that. It's not like that with gastroparesis. It's trial and error, even with the diet. If you're lucky enough to be sent home with a diet, and some are not, then, you know, not everything on that diet works for everybody. You have to track it. You have to keep a journal. You have to keep trying different things and eliminating different things until you find something that works for you, because the treatment is so individual. And there aren't any medications that you can try. So you just have to kind of take those in order. You know, you take Zofran, and if that doesn't work for you, you take Phenergrin, and you go down the list. And, you know, people want, they come into the groups and they want answers. Okay, what do I do about this? And that's a very hard question to answer, because there just really isn't one thing that works for everyone.
This is Mary Angela, and capitalizing on what you just said, what I have found in myself as well as with other patients, there are two things. One is some patients are only affected by solids. Some are only affected by liquids, and some, and I run into this last category, are affected by both. The other thing is, you may find that you can eat a certain food and you're doing okay with it. And then, you know, you spend maybe weeks, maybe months, maybe years, you seem to be able to monitor, and then suddenly, boom. Whatever you're eating, that same food now causes problems. It's very unpredictable in nature. So a lot of patients also say, gee, you know, I'm feeling pretty good now. Am I cured? That's a loaded question. We've seen people go into some sort of remission, but I don't know. No, I don't have an answer for that one. I know we have somebody else who posed a question here, and they wanted to know, has anyone been misdiagnosed with pancreatitis instead of gastroparesis because of slightly elevated enzymes?
That question came from me. My name is Nicole Tavares.
Hi, Nicole.
Hi. I came down with symptoms in December of 2016. I was seen at Yale, and I had slightly elevated liver pancreatic enzyme. And so they had said that I had pancreatitis. And so they started treating me for pancreatitis. I had an upper endoscopy, a regular endoscopy. All showed normal. I had an MRCP, MRI showed normal. Ultrasound showed normal, but yet I wasn't able to eat. I had lost 30 pounds. I was down to 92 pounds. And so they thought that maybe my gallbladder was causing it. So they removed my gallbladder, which was perfectly healthy. There was no sludge or no gallstones or anything wrong with the gallbladder. I then sought care in Philadelphia as well as Boston. And I am seen out of Boston now at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. I was hospitalized there for 8 days and given an NG tube, and I now have a GJ tube. And I think one of the things that's been really helpful with having the GJ tube is being able to go through the process that you were just discussing. So I've been able to figure out what I can tolerate and what I can't because I can rely on the GJ tube. So if something doesn't agree with me or doesn't work for me and I need to stop eating for a few days, then I can rely on the tube knowing that I'm going to get nutrition and not lose weight. And I don't have that anxiety anymore. So by having that tube in place for me, it's really helped me be able to do the elimination diet without starving myself at the same time. And I just am wondering if anybody else has had a misdiagnosis related to a gallbladder or the pancreas before ultimately being diagnosed with gastroparesis. I had a pancreatic test done up in Boston as well. Again, the pancreas showed completely normal. It's a rare test that only a few centers perform, but the pancreas showed normal. So I was completely misdiagnosed. And again, just wondering if that's happened to anybody else. I know that lipase is made in the stomach as well, which can cause mildly elevated enzymes.
Anybody want to respond? Mrs. Mary Angela.
Yeah, this is Melissa. Actually, that's very interesting because I was not misdiagnosed with pancreatitis, but that is the reason I was admitted to the hospital when I came to the emergency room, because they found elevated enzymes and they thought it could be pancreatitis. And that's what ended up, that was the criteria they used to admit me to the hospital. And then following tests showed nothing abnormal. So they went down a different path, but that's pretty interesting. Yeah.
Do you mind, me asking what your level was, if you recall?
Oh, that I do not recall. That's been too long ago for me. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm just asking. That's interesting too. Thank you for sharing that.
And this is Mary Angela again. It's amazing how many people that I've spoken with, and just on the aside, I have had pancreatitis, but again, I have pseudo obstruction and some other things, so that's why I'm not really commenting too much on what you said. However, so many patients have indicated to me that they've had their gallbladder removed and it still didn't help them on their quest for either finding out if they have gastroparesis or in trying to help the gastroparesis. I'm wondering how many people on this call have gone through the same thing where they've had the surgery to remove a gallbladder, which wasn't inflamed, but just because. Anybody?
This is Laura. Yep, this is Laura. They took my gallbladder out, trying to figure out what was wrong. They had no idea, so they thought that might be it. And took it out, and being a diabetic as long as I was, I guess it did still have some sludge in it, but it was still viable. But that did nothing for me except have a surgery.
Yeah. Has anybody that has had their gallbladder out now with the gastroparesis, does anybody have bile reflux now into the stomach? Where the bile is backing up into the stomach because there's no place for it to go and because of the gastroparesis?
This is Debbie. I had my gallbladder removed in, I want to say it was 2010. And at that point in time, it was diseased. It was very diseased. But once I had it removed, nothing changed. Like all my symptoms remained the same. And I wasn't diagnosed with gastroparesis until 2017. So I suffered since 2010 with this. And although it was diseased, taking it out made no difference. And when you bring up bile reflux, oh boy. And that's what they're saying right now is causing my esophagus to have spasms, is because all of the acid that's coming up into my throat is just like incredible. And, you know, like starting at square one right now again, after all this time, it's like, ugh.
One of the things that I have the GJ tube, so I'm able to check to see if there is bile in my stomach and empty it out as needed. So that's been a positive with having the tube, as well as I can empty out that bile. So I don't know if you have a tube or not, but that's just been something that's been helpful for me to be able to release that bile that's now being irritating my stomach and making me sick sometimes.
And that's one of the questions that I'm going to actually be speaking to my doctor later today. And one of the other things, and the reason why I wanted to be on this call, is, you know, I'm interested in learning about the pseudo obstruction, because I'm being told through CAT scan imaging, which I cannot have contrast, I can only do barium, that there's no blockage, but my doctor still thinks that I have a roadblock, he's calling it. And how did you get diagnosed with pseudo obstruction, Mary Angela?
I got diagnosed. Now, I've had this for almost 40 years. But when I first got diagnosed, they did all these manometry tests. I had the Sitz marker. I had a whole gang of others. And then I had, and I was down to 69 pounds. So it was based on my medical history as well. Now, this is after, you know, a lot of misdiagnoses. Then they did a small bowel biopsy. And through all of the results of all the tests, as well as the biopsy, and in addition to my medical history, it was very clear that I had pseudo-obstruction. And some of the symptoms, I would give myself at the time a water enema, the old-fashioned type, and I would administer the enema, and not only the water did come out, no stool came out. So then at the same time, then I would give myself another, and then another, and another, and nothing would come out. The pain and distension, excruciating. And so that's how it was diagnosed years and years ago. But it was through extensive testing and finding a doctor, because a lot of doctors are unaware of pseudo-obstruction. A lot of doctors to this day, because of the name, thinks, oh, pseudo, it's in your head. But it is it's your intestines acting as if there is a true obstruction there. Doesn't mean that we don't get obstructions, because I've had partial obstructions. But it is the intestines reacting as if there is. So you can imagine how painful that is. And I don't know if you're getting pain and distension along with your other symptoms.
Yes, very much so. My pain, I was in the ER twice in the last 2 weeks, or 3 weeks, I'm sorry. And my pain was at a level 9, and my blood pressure was 177 over 133.
Yeah.
And so now I'm having to go to cardiology today to have a complete cardiac workup, you know, because they're hesitant to rule out the heart and just chalk it up to pain. I'm just lost. I'm just completely lost right now.
Yeah. I'm sorry you're going through that. After this program at 12:15, there's that pseudo-obstruction program. I'm not sure if you signed up for that.
I thought that's what this was. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no. You're welcome here anyway.
I mean, I have both, but I thought that was what this was. I apologize.
No, because I'm sure there are other patients here who have reflux and have other things as well as gastroparesis. Am I correct on that, audience?
This is, yes. Jason.
Hi, Jason.
Hi. I do also, it's very interesting that to hear your history. I also have a pseudo-obstruction, and that's what started my gastroparesis. So it's interesting to hear from others that have that. And to speak more to what Debbie was saying, I was also diagnosed with the pseudo-obstruction with antroduodenal manometry, so an advanced manometry test at a motility center. And that's how they sort of figured out what was going on with me.
Did it take a long time for that diagnosis?
You know, it didn't. I was very fortunate, sort of like what Melissa was saying earlier. I got sick very suddenly. I was on a business trip and I couldn't eat. Called my wife and said, I need to get into the doctor as soon as I get home. And my primary care doctor sent me immediately to a gastroenterologist who did an endoscopy right away, found all the food remaining in my stomach, and said immediately, you know, this is not something I can handle. I'm going to send you on to a motility center. So I was, moved through the ranks very quickly. And then the motility center, it took me a little while to get in to see them, about 6 months. But once I got in to see them, they did the testing quickly and did the manometry the same day that I saw them for my initial consult. And were able to, they really moved me through quickly. So, but I mean, I got the diagnoses. It just didn't help me much. Like you were saying, now I've got a name for it, but it didn't, give me much to go on other than that.
Yeah. That's good and bad. And I remember those same things. Yay, it has a name. Finally, it qualifies what I'm going through. And oh no, now what do we do?
Right.
Exactly. Go home and live with it is what you do, and try to live with it as best you can. And that's another thing where it's very unpredictable in nature. What works for one patient may not work for another in some cases. And I'm going to repeat this in the pseudo obstruction one, but things may progress to the entire digestive tract or another part of the digestive tract. And in some patients, it's just relegated to one area.
Yeah, it's very interesting to hear you say that. Also, I also have dysphagia that they found later. So,
I have that as well. Yep.
Right. Yeah.
So, and going back to gastroparesis, that's the same thing. There can be many causes of gastroparesis. Genetic is one. Different types of surgeries, different medications can cause it. Oh my God, there's a host of things. Some people get it post-viral.
Diabetes.
Thank you, Laura.
The biggest cause out there, diabetes. cause.
So there are, and then sometimes it's just idiopathic, which one doctor, when he was doing a presentation, said idiopathic means the doctor's an idiot because he can't find out what's wrong with you. And that was like the hit of the whole presentation. But it was very good. It's so different in many different people. And like Melissa said, what works for one may not work for another. And that goes for diet too. Anybody else want to jump in? Nope, not yet. Go ahead.
This is Karen.
Hi, Karen.
I just looked up quickly pseudo-obstruction. I've not heard that before, and I had I got very ill yesterday, and so I've got an urgent care appointment this afternoon because I don't like to show up at the emergency room. I've got so many different diagnoses and being on immunosuppressants, they don't ever know what to do with me, and they stick me back in isolation and start calling all my specialists. And then they say that I need to go off my immunosuppressant because I've probably been exposed to the flu and God knows what else. So it's always really challenging. So I just quickly looked up pseudo-obstruction, and I'm wondering if that's what I'm experiencing now on top of all my other diagnosis. So is this, how do you sign up for this next talk? I've only signed up for this one that you have right now.
You can either do it via our website or you can do it. Let's see, there was an email that was sent out, and you can go to the AGMD Facebook page, and there should be a link on that as well.
I don't do Facebook. I only found out I dialed in last month for the first time, so I'm still new to this. And like I said, I've never heard of pseudo obstruction before. So I'm still, I guess, trying to get all of my diagnosis. I was just diagnosed with gastroparesis a year ago. I thought, okay, now I've just got to figure out what to eat. And there's still all sorts of things going on. So I don't know that I have complete diagnosis yet.
Yeah.
If
sorry,
you go, go to
go ahead, sorry. Go ahead. No, go ahead, Melissa.
If you go to the AGMD webpage, in the About section, there's a calendar of events, and you will see that call listed on the calendar, and you can register, you know, right before it begins and get into that.
The website address is www.agmdhope.org.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I'll do that. It sounds like some people are new to gastroparesis, or they've just started out on their journey. Is that correct?
It is for me. Just a year, so I'm still trying to figure things out. And you said, it can change day to day. There's no normal day. You have to go with the punches every day.
Right. Laura, because you have the neurogastric stimulator, I wonder if anybody else has that as well. Anybody?
I do. My name is Melissa, and I have the neurogastric stimulator.
And has that helped you?
Not really.
How long have you had it?
I've had it since March of 2015. Mm-hmm. I had it put in Augusta, Georgia. And I was really, I'm much like everybody, have multiple diagnoses. And I got so sick that I had to leave my job and go on disability and et cetera, et cetera. And they put that in, and it really, I was hoping it would make a big difference, but it really didn't. So I actually am on TPN right now because there was just, they didn't know what else to do because I just couldn't keep down any foods. So that's, I'm on TPN 16 hours a day, and I still have the gastric stimulator, and it's still, it's all the way up to as far as it'll go, but I still am having major symptoms.
Yeah.
This is Jason. I also have one, and I would actually mimic what Melissa just said. I wouldn't say it's been all that helpful, or maybe it did help with my nausea. I can't say it didn't help me, but I'll say that it made my other symptoms worse. So it's almost been a mixed bag. It maybe fixed one problem, but it made my pain much, much more severe.
It's interesting. Laura, do you want to speak on the neurogastric stimulator?
Well, I wanted to ask, what was that, Jason?
Yes.
Yes.
Spoke Jason and I believe Debbie. When you guys were presented, I guess, with your gastric stimulator by your doctors, what were you told it does? Like, what's it supposed to do for you?
I was told that it would... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead first.
Okay. They told me that it would help with nausea. That was the primary focus. Coincidentally, I had to fight quite a bit to get the insurance to cover it. I don't know if you've heard of the Jennifer Jaffe Center. They're no longer, unfortunately, around, but they helped me and wrote the letter. I had to appeal it to the State Board of Insurance, and I had to get my insurance company overruled in order to have the pacemaker placed or the stimulator placed. And they told me all along that it would only help with nausea. But then the interesting thing was when I actually went in to have the surgery done, the surgeon, who was a bariatric surgeon, told me that they had seen some studies where it may help slightly improve motility as well. So he did sort of set that expectation that it was possible to see some improvement in motility as well as just with the symptoms. I will say that didn't happen for me.
I find that very unfortunate that they said that to you. The simulator was created for and still is only created for nausea. It was originally...
Yeah, that's what my doctor said.
Yeah. And that's the only thing that it officially helps. Now, I'm not going to say that if it, say it helped you with your nausea and you weren't sick every day anymore, so you weren't throwing your food up every day, now you're digesting it, you're getting better nutrition, it can help other stuff. You know, because gastroparesis is definitely not a, like for most people, you know, your stomach doesn't digest 70% every time. Sometimes it works better than others. Sometimes it doesn't work at all. It, you know, flows and ebbs. And with the gastric stimulator, again, it was originally created for type 1 diabetics for nausea. And then because gastroparesis was, just as an FYI, everybody, 19 years ago, it was originally called diabetic gastroparesis. And then they suddenly realized that there was a, you know, just as many people out there with other reasons. So it became gastroparesis, idiopathic, etc. The simulator, again, was created back when they only thought it was a diabetic problem. But they have found so many people with idiopathic gastroparesis have been helped with their nausea from it. You know, it's a very hard thing. Other than, like, gastroparesis with medication, everything's a trial and error. Well, this is just by its nature, it's an experimental humanitarian device. It's only supposed to be used after every single option, Reglan, you know, domperidone, anything that could be out there has been used and failed. That's the official line on a humanitarian device. But it really has found, you know, helped a lot of people. But there is a huge misconception out there with doctors that tell people, right, it's going to help your nausea, stop your vomiting, help your bowels, do this. That's not good information, I guess. And I preach the stimulator, and if anybody ever has any questions, I was the 125th person in the world, 105th person in the world to get it from the doctor that created it in the FDA study a long time ago. So I do know a little about this. You know, there's a lot of gastroparesis stuff, but this is kind of my deal. And if anybody ever has any questions or wants information or just wants to talk about possibility, let Mary Angela know. I am happy to share anything about it. Any questions, anything. And if anybody does have any questions right now, I'm happy to answer them.
This is Melissa again. I have a quick question.
Sure.
So, when I got my gastric stimulator, I had one doctor that said it probably wouldn't help very much because I had overall dysmotility. I also have pseudo obstruction, and along with the gastroparesis, I have bile reflux, acid reflux, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
But one doctor was like, it's not going to help your nausea. They did tell me it was for nausea. And I had another doctor say, oh, it'll help you nausea. So we went ahead and tried it because I was just pretty much desperate at that point. And had it inserted. And I wouldn't say that it hasn't helped at all. I feel like it maybe has helped a tiny bit with my nausea. I'm still, you know, on Dofran and Phenagrin and Domperidone and everything else.
I take all of that still too, and you know,
right,
but it does
right,
help
right.
a and, little.
Right, and so my question to you is because they're thinking that, you know, it was inserted in 2015, and they're already trying to think, what are we going to do when the battery runs out? You know, are we going to insert another one, or are we just going to take it out? And, you know, I've told them, you know, I'm not sure, because I feel like it's helped a little bit, you know, just a little bit. So, I mean, would your advice be to me to go ahead and, you know, have it because I know they don't replace the battery, they replace the whole thing.
The unit, right. You know, that's just how they
Right. Would your advice be to just get another unit? Because I have heard some people say that once they get their second unit, that they actually, it actually is even better.
Well, I would never give advice whether to do it or not because it's always an individual thing. You know, it's totally your decision. However, you are correct in the fact that sometimes even from 2000, let's say 13, maybe, and then I had one in 2012. I had a replacement put in 2012. I just had to replace it the beginning of 2017, five years. The new one that I got is more technically advanced than the one before. And it allows for more power settings, different adjustments, different things, which in turn can certainly help people. You know, you could certainly, if you could, maybe if we turned it up a teeny bit more or mine shocks a little longer than normal, you know, and it really, the technology is amazing. The first one I had one electronic level. There was no adjustments. It was on or off. Did nothing. And it didn't die for over 9 years. It would not. So I could not get a new one. And then in 2012, after almost 10 years, it finally died. I got a new one they were now electronically adjustable, the shock waves and everything. Changed my life overnight. Overnight. I am a person with my symptoms basically nausea and vomiting 24/7. I did that for 2 years straight before I got the stimulator, lost 100 pounds. I mean, I was bad. And that's always been my biggest symptom. Now, I would say more than anything, my symptoms are more the bloating and the pain and the other things that go with it because it does control my nausea. And, you know, the beauty of the newer ones, too, it's not working. Okay, go in. After a month or so, turn it up just a little. Give it another month. You know, people got to give it a little time because they use it's usually not instant like I was. I mean, I woke up from the surgery going, I'm saved. Not really, but, you know, I was like, I'm saved. It's something that worked. And, you know, and it is a big decision for you. If you're so sick and your life is so bad, which we all go through it, believe me, and it's worth it to you to have that teeny bit of help, by all means, keep it. Because if you get rid of it and then getting a new one, that's almost insurance-wise impossible.
Right.
So, you know, but that's how I would judge it, is that little bit that it's helping worth it. And to me, it certainly was, even in the very beginning.
Okay.
You know, and now it is more than ever.
Anybody else want to jump in? Thank you, Laura.
Sure.
Thank you.
Anybody else have a question?
I think there's a question in the chat.
Is there?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
From Ms. Heather.
Oh, I just saw it. Yes.
Hi, Ms. Heather.
Good morning. Sorry, I jumped in on the West Coast. I didn't realize the time slipped away. So I don't know if you or not, but
no, I have welcome. Go ahead.
Surgery. And I didn't know if anybody had any tips on managing the symptoms when you have adhesions with your gastroparesis.
Good question. Anybody? Wow, nobody's had any surgeries. That's amazing.
I'm sorry.
This is Laura. Gabby. This is Gabby. I've had lots of surgeries. specifically cleaning adhesions off of my bowel that were adhesed to my abdominal wall. So I wonder all the time if that plays a role in what's going on with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mine's all up in my upper left quadrant, and it's affecting my small intestines and my esophagus as well. And it's just really hard to find treatment options and any relief, really, because it's hard to digest the medications as well. So I was hoping to... I'm always looking to throw it out there because it's very hard to find information about surgical gastroparesis. It's usually diabetic or idiopathic. And when you find something that does mention it, there's really no, you're kind of, you know, asked out on solutions. So that's been my motto, is just to suck it up, buttercup, and keep going. I appreciate the opportunity to throw it out there again.
We'll make a note of that too, because it sounds like something that there's a need to find more information. So let me just make a note of that. Good question. And I see that you had a fund application.
I've had, the way they say it is you've had one fund application and two redos. And now it's failed for the third time, but they won't do it. They won't fix anymore because of the adhesions are so bad. So I'm kind of just left to find my way through it, you know.
Oh my gosh. Unbelievable.
I live on Zofran, the dissolvable tablets, but I tell them I eat those like Tic Tacs. But yeah, you know, that's in the meantime, it's just like I feel like I'm just waiting it out, you know, writing out the symptoms. So it's unfortunate. I want to do anything I can to get more awareness out on it.
Well, that's very important. And speaking of awareness, Melissa, will you talk about the event that's coming up?
The March or the Facebook event? You have mentioned both, and I'm happy to talk about either or both.
Let's start with Washington first.
Washington, D.C., the Gastroparesis community is going to be descending on Washington, D.C. For a rally on June 24th of this year. We already have about somewhere around 250 people signed up to attend, and we're hoping to have about 500 or more if we can recruit them. We plan to go to D.C. I just filed the permit, so we're not exactly sure what section of the Capitol grounds we'll be on, but we will be at the Capitol grounds, and we will be dressed in green and waving our signs and fighting to get better care, coverage for our medications, and pushing a research bill that we hope will be reintroduced to get us much needed education and research funding so that they can start finding the cause and some better treatments and possibly a cure for gastroparesis.
How many days is it going to be?
It will actually be, the rally will be a one-day event. It will be for a few hours in the afternoon on that Monday, June 24th. But at the same time as our rally, that Monday and Tuesday, so June 24th and 25th, the IFFGD will be hosting a conference. We will be talking about, on that Monday morning of the conference, we will be talking about gastroparesis and gastroparesis-related problems and issues. And then that Monday afternoon, we will break from the conference, head over to our rally. And the second day of the conference, the Tuesday, we will actually have meetings with our individual legislators, probably mostly House representatives, scheduled for anybody who's interested in attending so that we can also educate them about gastroparesis and our needs and what we hope for the future.
Wow, that's wonderful. I give you a lot of credit. what about the Facebook thing that's going on?
The Facebook event. Oh my goodness, this is an anxiety producing event for me. I was actually invited. I'm an administrator in some of the online support and advocacy groups, Facebook groups, and Facebook actually invited me to attend their Facebook community summit on February 6th to 9th. And I will be speaking on a medical and health panel there, hopefully talking about gastroparesis some, but also specifically about how the support and advocacy groups on Facebook can help us better spread awareness, what kind of features might be helpful to help us run the groups and make them serve as a better support system for patients and their loved ones. So I'm excited. They're flying me out to California, and I'm scared out of my mind, of course, but afraid I won't survive it. But I'm excited to talk about our community and tools that can better help us manage it.
That's excellent. Excellent. We're all going to be rooting for you. Nice that you serve as the voice for gastroparesis for those patients who are unable to get involved, either going to Washington or, you know, having these other opportunities. That being said, you all have a voice and you all can advocate on behalf of yourselves. And you automatically do that when you're diagnosed because you're teaching medical community, family members, even other patients and the general public about gastroparesis and what you go through. You may not have all the answers, but neither do the doctors. That's okay. I also wanted to tell you that if you haven't visited our new website, I encourage you to do so. We are constantly updating it with new audio support, recordings, all different types of information, educational materials, etc. Something to worth look at. There's a place where you can research doctors who treat motility and centers that treat motility patients, as well as dietitians. It's still a work in progress, as all websites are, but I encourage you to visit it at agmdhope.org. And lastly, I wanted to say that we are going to be publishing a new e-magazine. We were putting out monthly newsletters, but I thought it might be better, we thought it might be better to go with quarterly magazine. And this magazine is for all of you. So we're reaching out to see if anybody would like to contribute any photos of their pets or of themselves as patients or the patients with their families, any poetry, artwork, photography, any pictures of your swollen or wounded bellies, and any articles. Anything else that you think you'd like to see published, you can certainly submit it for publication consideration. If you have a great submission and it doesn't get in this one, don't worry, it will get in the next one, and you will receive an acknowledgement if your item is accepted for the publication. And in the meantime, we only have a couple more minutes, so I want to really wind this up on the typical way that I wind up these programs. First of all, don't forget the pseudo-obstruction one coming up, the program coming up right after this at 12:15. And then in February, we have our next gastroparesis group on February 26th. It will be on a Tuesday at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. We also have a parent group that will be going on February 11th, and the pseudo-obstruction one will be on the 26th, again at 12:15. I want to thank you all for participating. If you were in the shadows, just listening, I pray that you did get something out of this program. And if you were one of the ones who offered a little piece of your life or a question that's been preying on your heart, I want to thank you so much. It truly is a humbling experience when people want to come to these meetings and either listen in or share what's going on in their lives. It's a very personal thing. And so we just appreciate everybody who comes to these programs, and even for those who are unable to, because I know there's a time difference as well. Remember, when you leave this meeting, your lives will go on. My life will be really thinking about all of you, as I do at the end of all of these programs. It doesn't end here. I think about all of you. I pray for all of you. And I just am there with you in heart, because you are the heroes. You're living with this 24 hours a day. And I admire all of you. I am so sorry you're going through the suffering you're going through. But I'm so proud to be walking that walk with you. Melissa, you have anything you want to close with?
Just really quickly, there is a question in the chat. I have not been officially diagnosed with GP due to not being able to complete the emptying test. However, I was just diagnosed with SMAS. Can these go hand in hand? Ms. Jennifer, sometimes they can. A lot of times weight loss, extreme weight loss can lead to SMAS. So that's something you might want to speak to your physician about. They can do some tests to help you find that out. But sometimes, yes, they can go hand in hand. And I want to thank everybody for showing up. Really appreciate it. Really appreciate all you do to support each other and to support advocacy efforts and to support the AGMD. And we welcome you to join us next month, too.
Okay. Thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you, Mary Angela. And thank you, Melissa. Right.
God bless you all. Take care.
Thank you, Mary Angela and Melissa. I see you're all so active out there on the Facebook groups and Twitter, and I appreciate everything that you do.
Thank you so much.
So much. Bye-bye.
Bye.